we'll start kind of at the beginning of the week. At the beginning of this week, I wrote a story, 16-inch MacBook Pro reveal likely this week as Apple appears to be holding private press briefings. And it was kind of gone out on a limb there, bro, because I didn't know, it's nothing solid. And I actually, like, something I'll admit to you is I didn't promote this on Twitter. it's like let the site do it. I'll just kind of see where this goes. But I wasn't confident enough in it to, like, tweet it on my own timeline.
I mean, it wasn't, like, it's not a secret when journalists leave their residency homes and fly to New York or wherever for a press briefing,
like, right? And it's like
people tweet about they're on the flight or they show their Apple Watch with the ticket on it. Like, it's not, it's not SAS security. Yeah.
And I will say it was a combination that made me like. Well, I'll start from the beginning of even the story. I saw multiple people in the press who always attend the events traveling, whether it was from Twitter or Instagram or wherever. Like, people were letting people know that they were traveling all to the same place. I guess when you do it independently, you don't realize that it's like putting together this big pattern. But then the thing that like sealed the deal for me, because that could have been for like, here's a hands-on with the Mac Pro, earlier they had that, but now it's closer to launch. But it was the fact that we've had all of these, like accidental leaks from Apple in their own software of this is what the MacBook Pro will look like and, sort of what's different about it. It was not like, if we didn't have those leaks and this was the news this week, was this is the MacBook Pro, then we would have had the whole cycle of like, whoa, that's not a big update. It's not looks wise. But we already got past
we've already
that.
Kind of been prepped.
Yeah, we already got past
to a decent degree. There were a few surprises this week, but to a decent degree, we were prepped ahead of time.
Indeed. And then I saw someone selling their MacBook in the press, which I think was just a coincidence because the listing was like older than everything else happening, but only by a few days. But then I was just like, yeah, this is the MacBook. Like, they must know someone who knows something about this, and they're like offloading as soon as they can to get the new thing. So we kind of talked about it internally, and it was like, yeah, let's run the story. And it was a total gamble, and my headline hedged a little bit, but fortunately, like the next day, our old pal Mark Gurman at Bloomberg had a story on not just the fact that yes, it's coming this week, but that how much it will cost. And a few more things about it, and Mark's coverage was what, spot on, basically.
Sounds like
somebody probably had the briefing and then they didn't like stay inside after that period because it was this is the price, this is sort of the specs to expect, and it's the just starting from there. The big surprise is there were reports on pricing being $3,000 and up for the new machine, which made us assume that it would not replace the 15-inch laptop in the lineup. The 16-inch MacBook would be a higher tier and maybe eventually work its way down. But that didn't quite happen. Instead, it was $600 less than that at $2,400, the same price as the 15-inch MacBook Pro. And then that MacBook Pro just isn't sold by Apple directly anymore. So it's out of the lineup in terms of that.
That has to be one of the shortest shelf life Apple products that I can think of.
Yes, because updated this year. Yeah,
so it was revved in May with the, the butterfly keyboard with the new materials, and then gone in mid-November, essentially. Mm-hmm. And the only thing I can think is close would be the iPad third generation. So that was iPad with Retina display, and that was the one where Retina came to the iPad, but it got really hot, and it had to be thicker, and it still had the 30-pin jack, 30-pin port connector. Yeah. When all the iPhone rumors at the time were they're moving to Lightning, and then by the October time period, they retired the iPad 3, gave it a Lightning port, it gave it the newer processor, so it could actually manage the screen a lot better. But I think that would have been 1 month longer because that was like March to October, whereas this was May to November. So
yeah. So what's in this new 16-inch MacBook Pro, which is like the big story of the week? You've got the price already, $2,400. You've got what we saw in the leaks, the Touch ID key being separate from the Touch Bar, which made us assume that the what we are hearing about the Escape key being separate from the Touch Bar, physical key was correct. That the overall look of this is the same design as the current lineup since 2016. And that the screen is a little bit bigger, it's bigger, but it's not radically different looking.
Yeah, the footprint of the machine is slightly bigger, like if you look at the raw dimensions, not proportionate to the increase in diagonal screen size, because the bezels on the left and the right hand side of the screen are thinner. They're not like razor thin, but they are slimmer. It seems like the bezels on the top and bottom are about the same. They've just kind of shrunk the left and right, which is fine, I guess, right? It's not the radical design overhaul that I was kind of hoping it would be, and obviously our expectations were downtrodden a bit in the last couple of weeks when we've seen the leaked assets and stuff, and this definitely represents the leaked assets. But because it replaces the 15-inch at the 15-inch price point, it's a lot more acceptable. If they'd have come in with this at, you know, the rumored $3,000, and the 15-inch would still be sticking around for the time being, then it'd have been a lot more, like, hard to stomach and disappointing, because that's the price true. Is actually very competitive. Like, even if you max this out to, like, top spec, which we can talk more about in a minute, is the price is actually not earth-shatteringly bad, given the pretty pro high-performance, you know, professional specifications you actually get on the show.
Yeah, they... It's a better purchase, of course, than the 15-inch was earlier this year, but it's also a better purchase than any of the 15-inches have been since 2016, because things like the price for storage has gone down, so you can get much more for your buck now than
you could
then.
Yeah, and you get 512 gigabytes base storage now, whereas before it was 256. Mm-hmm. So you're already getting twice the amount of SSD space at the $2,399 base price. The CPU is the same as what they had in May with the May revision. But that's fine. As far as I know, Intel don't have anything better to give the laptop at the moment, so they're literally on the cutting edge of it anyway. And because this new MacBook Pro, although it looks quite similar on the outside, Apple says they've re-engineered the internals for a new like thermal design, so it should beat the 15-inch from May on performance anyway, because it'll be able to have a better thermal window on it, which means it can last. It means the CPU can keep running at turbo boost speeds for longer. Mm-hmm. So it's still quite premature for benchmarks and stuff to come out, but I'm expecting this thing still to be quicker on CPU performance on it anyway, even though the CPU chips are identical. Just the fact that they've got better airflow and better internal spacing, and the machine is slightly thicker, it should address the thermal situation quite well, and it'll be more comfortably in the window, so it can last on the turbo speeds for longer, because it can turbo boost up to 5 gigahertz. So that should still be an improvement. On the GPU side, the new GPU in the machine can apparently be up to 80% faster than the previous generation, so it's quite a big jump in GPU, at least according to Apple specs. You get new speakers, there's new mics, the 1 hour longer battery life, because now it fits a 100 watt battery, which is apparently the limit of what you're allowed to take on a plane in a device. So they literally can't go any bigger realistically for a laptop, and that results in 1 hour battery life, so you get 11 hours not 10 hours, which was the rated battery life of the 15-inch MacBook Pro. Battery life performance is a big open question depending on usage and what you're doing, obviously, so, but still it seems like you'll get, you know, some more lifetime. And by far the most eminent or preeminent improvement to this machine is the death of the butterfly keyboard and the introduction of what they call the magic keyboard.
Which is not to say that they've gone back to scissor switches, just like they used on the previous, like 2015 and earlier MacBook Pro, but they are using scissor switches. But it's just that the travel is reduced from that keyboard. It's increased from the butterfly keyboard, and it's more in line with what you get with the desktop keyboard that you can buy that comes with an iMac, or that you can buy separately.
Yeah, they call it the magic keyboard, but it's not identical to the external keyboard for various reasons, space and stuff.
Angle, like yeah.
Yeah, angle, exactly. Obviously, the external keyboard is raised up anyway.
Backlighting, yeah.
Yeah, and the laptop keyboard, you use it from a slightly different position, like ergonomically, so... It is different. I think the butterfly keyboard had half a millimeter travel. This has 1 millimeter travel, and the old scissor switch keyboard had 1.25 to 1.5 millimeters roughly. So it's, you know, kind of splitting the difference down the way, but you're doubling the travel from the butterfly keyboard. So people that want slightly more travel should be pretty happy here. Obviously, the reliability is a big thing you know, people don't trust Butterfly keyboards, even though the May revision seems to be doing pretty well. Like, we haven't heard of big issues with it. It's still only 6 months in, and if you look over a longer span of time, it did seem like Butterfly keyboards were higher for higher failure rates than what came before them. So going back to a scissor mechanism at least gives people the confidence that this should not, you know, exhibit the same degree of issues. We don't know for sure. Obviously, only time will tell us that. But, you know, it feels... You'd hope that, A, Apple has done their testing this time around, right, for the brand new keyboard designed for the new laptop. And because the components are more traditional, they're less innovative, they're still... They're not identical to what came before, but they're along the same evolutionary geology of keyboards, right? Like, it comes from a less precarious position. Plus, the tolerances are better. Like, part of the issue with the Butterfly keyboard, they were so small and so thin that, you know, very, very small dust would actually be a big obstacle for the, you know, half millimeter travel. You'd only need something very, very small to get in there. Even just expanding the tolerances from, you know, 0.5 to 1 millimeter, that just helps a lot more about, like, just crush particles because there's a bigger distance to go, or there's less areas for stuff to get in and stuff. So hopefully the reliability will be better here. And at the same time, they're addressing, you know, what people are upset about. You have the inverted T arrow keys now. You have a physical escape key, and the touch bar's, like, inset a bit more. Me, personally, I didn't really care about the inverted T situation. I actually got used to the four-way thing, and in some regards it might be considered as better because it obviously meant the left and right keys were bigger. So for me, a lot of time when I'm doing like text editing, I'm going left and right quite a lot, so theoretically if the keys are bigger, that's actually better. But I never had a problem with the T's before, with the T-shape before, so I don't really care. The escape key design I think is A, superior in terms of tactility because you actually get a physical key now for what is got to be the most commonly hit key on that top row, the escape key. And it just looks better visually because before, when the touchpad went all the way across, the first key, like the screen of the touch bar, was always inset anyway. Like, it always looked weird. It didn't start at the left hand side of the touch bar. There was like the whole width of the keys below. There's a whole width of that first before you'd even have the next key there. So now they've gone to a design where the physical escape key kind of buffers and mirrors the Touch ID button on the other side, and the screen of the touch bar is closer to where it begins as well. So they've just kind of modernized it in both ways. And obviously people are happy that they can actually, you know, slam their finger down on a real button for escape now.
Yeah, if you're an app developer, do you have to make any changes to target this version of the touch bar, or does it just work out?
It's complicated, actually. Okay. The dimensions of the touch bar are different because obviously the physical escape key's gone, and the way that it's laid out anyway, the physical number of pixels you have on the touch bar is actually reduced on what they call the second generation touch bar. So there could be situations where the toolbars do not lay out exactly the same as they used to because you have less space. Plus, there was actually customization you can do where you could change the software escape key and put a different button there. So that'll be the most obvious difference if you were comparing side by side, is that if the APIs were, if the app developers were using the like replacement for the escape key button, for instance, in Calculator on, you know, Mac 2016, if you open Calculator, the escape key changes to an AC button, which is obviously the clear button reflecting the calculator. That won't show up anymore. You can just press escape. There are API affordances to allow developers to still show those buttons if they were crucial to being required. I think one example actually is the contacts app. So before, on the contacts app, the done button, like the blue done button when you're finished editing the contacts, would replace the escape key, whereas now you still have physical escape and they've retained the done button on the actual screen as well. So there are minor differences, but overall most developers' use of the touch bar was not that sophisticated, right? Because it wasn't that popular, and it's still unclear exactly how much you get used. So for most cases, everything will just be slightly closer together and it should be fine.
Nice. And there were no changes in the way that, even though it's the second generation touch bar, as they call it, we don't know that it's brighter. They would certainly say that. And there's,
yeah, they didn't say anything about it. There's no haptics.
Or, yeah, fewer pixels, so there's not more, you know, not denser. And then also, yeah, no haptics, which is kind of one of the things that you'd want from day one. And then at glance, it can be a bit dim sometimes. It can be a bit fuzzy, even though it is, you know, retina class display. So,
well. Yeah, and on back on the keyboard, the spacing between the keys, there's more spacing between each key now, because I know some people didn't like that, what they did with the butterfly design, where they made the keys closer together. And now there's like again, it's not all the way back to what the old keyboard was, but it's somewhere in between. And they do say that despite going back to, you know, dome switches and scissor switch mechanism, the new keyboard should have a more stable key feel, which is reminiscent of one of the advantages of the butterfly keyboard, which is that it doesn't really matter if you hit on the very left-hand side or the very right-hand side of a keycap. The whole button kind of goes down in one go, whereas before it would kind of be like a diving board of like it would kind of like tilt from side to side depending on when you hit the key. And it does feel better. That's one of the, you know, one of the clear wins of the butterfly design, mm-hmm. was it does feel better when the whole key goes down together. And apparently they've managed to do that on this new keyboard despite it being, you know, scissor switches. Hiring these days takes time. Time that you often don't have. Sometimes filling a role is urgent, but you want to make sure you're filling a role with a quality candidate that is truly meant for your business. So how do you do it? It isn't as simple as putting an ad in the newspaper or posting to a job board. This is where LinkedIn Jobs comes in. It's the best place to post your job. Get up and running from the LinkedIn Jobs dashboard. Simply start with your company name, job title, and location. Education and grades are important, but LinkedIn also considers qualities like collaboration, work ethic, adaptability. LinkedIn Jobs finds people that are not only qualified, but fit in with your company's culture. LinkedIn does the legwork to find the most qualified candidates so you can focus on hiring the person who will transform your business. It looks beyond plain work skills and connects you with candidates who match your business perfectly. LinkedIn makes sure your job post gets in front of the people that you want to hire. It's no wonder a person is hired every 8 seconds on LinkedIn. And companies rated LinkedIn Jobs the number one hiring platform for delivering quality hires. Find the right person for your business today with LinkedIn Jobs. You can pay what you want and get the first $50 off. Just visit linkedin.com/happyhour. Again, that's linkedin.com/happyhour to get $50 off your first job post. Terms and conditions apply. Thanks to LinkedIn Jobs for sponsoring the show.
Yeah, they've mixed the good ideas and with the old ways and hopefully getting rid of the bad ideas. And I mean, it means something that this keyboard doesn't have to launch with a dedicated service program for multiple years, like we've seen it with the previous ones. I used the 2015 MacBook 12-inch, and that was the first butterfly keyboard. I used that for a long time, and I didn't have as many issues with that as I had with like later MacBook Pro versions that had the keyboard, which is a little bit odd. I'm not sure why, but maybe it was just how long I got to use it. But I did use the first generation and second generation and third generation butterfly keyboard, but not the revised version. So that's where, if you had the MacBook Air that got the butterfly keyboard, the revised version could be replaced in that machine, and then new MacBook Pros. Actually, I've never used a third generation one. I take that back, because I had the MacBook Air and it could have gotten the keyboard, but I never got a chance to do like the service on it. And then the MacBook Pro sold after that point. They had them. So I don't have any experience with the third generation revised, just the third generation before the revision. And that one definitely did have issues. The second generation definitely has issues that I'm still dealing with today. But yeah, it's kind of weird that this is like the most interesting thing about this whole machine is that like you can recommend the keyboard. And I did a story this week on like, can you recommend any MacBook now? Like, can you just go and buy a MacBook now and have a good experience with the keyboard? And the framing for me was, I was thinking, like, what if someone in my family asked me, you know, which Mac laptop to buy, and what would my answer be? And just because of my experience with the keyboards, you know, and yours as well, and the fact that there's a service program for those keyboards from day one, that I just I would and mixed with the fact that Ming-Chi Kuo, who has a good track record on this stuff, believes that the new keyboards will make its way to the smaller MacBook Pro, so 13 inch, even if maybe that becomes a 14 inch, I don't know. The MacBook Air, like those machines, then that next year is eventually when all those machines are updated with the new keyboard, then we can say any MacBook in the lineup, you know, buy it. But right now it's just the high end one, which people in my family won't need. And I think, you know, for a lot of uses in college, you won't need to spend the $2,400 on the highest end MacBook Pro. So we're at the beginning of the end of this saga, you know, this nightmare, but we're not out of it yet.
and it's going to be a transition.
Yes.
And it's awkward. You know, Apple got into a bad spot, but they are digging themselves out of the hole. And yes, it is kind of, do you want to say disappointing? I don't know, the fact that the biggest change in this, you know, 2019 MacBook Pro is the fact that the keyboard is what it should have been 3 years ago. Like, it's always awkward, but it is also good that they've done
yes.
it. You know what I mean? Like, it's hard you want to criticize it, but at the same time, it's like, well, they have actually fixed it. Yeah, it's kind of like a pair of scales that are, you know, counterbalancing each other.
Yeah, without just giving, like, I think they had to give up on the MacBook 12 inch, you know, because this keyboard was made for that machine, and maybe they couldn't do this with twice the travel and still have it, you know, work the same way and be as thin. So that's something.
I wonder if it's going to be like another 3 or 4 years now before we see another like chassis redesign
right.
for the MacBook Pro, and that means another 3 or 4 years of like bigger bezels than I still like, no Face ID, that kind of situation, right? Like, it kind of feels bad if you look at the normal cadence of the MacBook Pro, it gets revved like every 4 years, and this one is every 3 years. Presumably they prioritized it because of the keyboard situation. But if we have to wait like another 3 or 4 year period before they add fundamental like design changes, which could include like Face ID or, you know, properly thin bezels with like rounded corners and stuff, that's going to be a shame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, I don't know what the pipeline looks like, but it'd be a bit like demoralizing if we're still looking at, you know, essentially the 2016 design in 2023.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, they do have things to improve still. So a few things. The port situation is exactly the same. So even though they've got a slightly bigger body, they don't have like six ports of USB-C Thunderbolt 3. They've got four, which with having the same chipset maybe makes sense. I don't know. They did no change to the wireless specs for Wi-Fi. So it's still 802.11ac. Even though iPhone 11, 11 Pro, and 11 Pro Max have Wi-Fi 6, which I think was called 802.11ax before it got the better name. Mm-hmm. So even though it's Pro and it's after that iPhone came out, it still has the earlier Wi-Fi for some reason. And we already knew that was going to be the case for the Mac Pro, but I kind of had hope that maybe they would change it for the Mac Pro between announcing it and releasing it based on the iPhone gaining Wi-Fi 6, but I don't think this is the case now that this MacBook is out. And there are practical reasons why you would want that on a MacBook deployed throughout an enterprise environment, or just to have the fastest Wi-Fi possible on your home machine. But iPhone only for now. And then like with the MacBook Air, remember in the keynote with the MacBook Air when they're like, we've got a webcam and it's in the, where you expect it. It's like the
right where you expect it at the top. Yeah.
It's like the slight to the one in the keyboard like area, at the bottom. They've got the keyboard on or the webcam on the top. That's why the bezel is, I guess, the same thickness on top. But it's still a 720p webcam. Now, if this was the $3,000 machine that we thought we might see, then that would really hurt. But you know, like you said, this is the better version of the 15-inch that they sold the day before. So same webcam, too bad. But it is kind of weird that you can do 1080p and now 4K on the front camera on the iPhone and on the MacBook Pros. They still don't.
Yeah, and it's not like they just did a spec update plus the keyboard. Mm-hmm. They did improve other features.
They re-engineered things, yeah.
Yeah, like the new microphones, right? So
yes.
There's a really good interview with Phil Schiller and Jonathan Morrison at
YouTube.
TOD Today. That's his YouTube channel. Mm-hmm. And he recorded the entire interview on the new microphones, which Apple describes as studio quality in their press release. I don't know if they're not quite that good, or maybe they are if you like bent over your keyboard and spoke directly into it. Yeah. But if you're sitting from a distance, like a podcast, you're still going to benefit from having an external mic. But you can just listen to that video, and it records Schiller and Morrison sitting like across each other on like a little sofa thing to a very good degree. It's like, wow, this could be really good if you're on like a web comp, or, you know, you're doing a web conference call, or you're doing like a little YouTube video for yourself. And then you think, well, you know, those things need video, but the Viv FaceTime camera is still 720p and really, really old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, it's a weird dichotomy there.
It is indeed. On the storage situation one more time, so the where you can max out the storage now is up to 8 terabytes, which I think in your coverage you described as the most in a laptop now. Is that right?
That is what Apple says.
Okay. So that will cost you $2,400 for the storage, but that's a lot of storage. And just sort of my context experience with this is that in 2016, when the 15-inch MacBook first came out, the 15-inch in this sort of design, the one thing I upgraded from the base model was storage from 256 to 1 terabyte SSD. And that cost, I think, $600 to do that. The end price was $3,000. So that was for the 1 terabyte upgrade. Now to go from $2,400 to add 1 terabyte is only $200 more. So it's a lot less. And the same $600 upgrade gets you 2 terabytes. So to double the incredible amount of SSD for $3,000, you know, if you don't change anything else about the machine. So, and then
kind of originates from their price cuts to storage that we talked about in like July timeframe, right?
Uh-huh,
like, yep. it wasn't that long ago when a 4 terabyte SSD in the MacBook Pro would cost you $2,800.
Yeah.
$2,800, right? Which is the same price as the base high configuration of this new one. And now you can get 8 terabytes for $2,400. So you're getting double the capacity for even less money. So between combining that July up like price cut plus the fact they now have an even higher top tier, it works out really well. Like,
yeah.
If you max out every spec on this MacBook Pro, that's like 64 gigs of RAM, which you couldn't get before, right? That's new. The 8-core i9, the 8 terabyte SSD, the better GPU. All in all, it comes to $6,099.
Yeah.
And yes, that's a lot of money, but for the maxed out MacBook Pro, that's not bad. Like, you know, you still have to stomach the cost of it if you're, you know, even if you're a professional, but still, like, for the maxed out version with an 8 terabyte SSD, that is, you know, I'd say that's perfectly acceptable, especially given it, you know, Apple's normal pricing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if this is your pro machine, like I know our video editor Jeff Benjamin, who manages our YouTube channel, was like, I want that 8 terabytes in this machine. You know, it can do so much stuff with that without offloading to an external drive. That's like a must have. So,
And what was kind of funny is in the embargoed interviews, like, Relay had one, ATP obviously had an Amazon MacBook Pro, and even in the like the first impressions from TOD today, when they recorded those videos, they didn't know the price sheet for all the build to order configurations. So when they mentioned the 8 terabyte SSD, they're like, well, we know it's going to cost a bomb, or it's going to cost 10 grand, like, or whatever. And then when it comes out, it's, you know, $6,099 for every upgrade, including the 8 terabyte SSD. Like, yeah. It does put it into perspective of, yeah, Apple's done a pretty good job here with pricing, I think.
Yeah, and what's a bit awkward is, so we got the release month, I won't say day, but release month for the Mac Pro and the Apple Pro Display XDR first shown back in June. So that'll be sometime in December, which when you say, you know, end of year, end of fall, then that, and we're in November, it kind of rules out any other month. But okay, December sometime, probably toward the end of the month. But that was introduced in June at WWDC, or previewed in June at WWDC with 64 gigabytes of SSD. Is that right? Is the base model
256 gigabyte SSD?
Oh, okay. 64 would have been terrible, but anyway.
Yes, it's 32 gigs of the base configuration for the $5,999 Mac Pro is 32 gigs of RAM, 256 gigabyte SSD.
Okay, and the reason that's so punitive is because it's 1/4 of what the base iMac Pro has. For obviously less money, but for different reasons. But this is, now you've got half of what the MacBook Pro has, And that's in part because the prices have changed for what it cost Apple to put an SSD in from, I guess, from the supplier. So it wouldn't be crazy for them to change the base model before launch, but probably not. But at least maybe.
Don't you think they would have announced that today, though?
Yeah, I do. And also, well, the one thing that they can change without doing something different is they haven't released upgrade pricing yet for anything. It's just the base model. So they could adjust the price for what it costs to get the, you know, 512, 1 terabyte, 2 terabyte, 8 terabyte. I wonder if they'll go higher than 8 terabyte in this because it is the Mac Pro. But at any rate, like whatever that will cost.
Yeah, the only spec thing they announced for the Mac Pro is that it will support an 8 terabyte SSD upgrade.
Oh, okay. So
you can get an 8 terabyte SSD on the Mac Pro. They didn't announce pricing for it,
right.
But they did say that obviously to match the MacBook Pro capacity.
Okay.
But if you just look at the base, like the Mac Pro just looks like a terrible deal. Like you get the base $5,999 Mac Pro is 32 gigs of RAM, 256 gigabytes of SSD. The base MacBook Pro, which is $2,400, gets a 512 gigabyte SSD. And if you, as we said before, if you max it out, it's $6,099, and you get 64 gigs of RAM and 8 terabyte SSD compared to $100 less for the base model Mac Pro. And so that's half the RAM and 32 times less amount of storage space.
Yeah, you have to really need the processor or something about the expansion slots.
Processor on the, because on the 6 night on the maxed out MacBook Pro, the processor should be about equivalent to the base processor in the Mac Pro. The GPU will be slightly worse, but the processor difference should be very, 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 very small because they're both 8 cores. It's just one's the Xeon W and the other's the i9. So it'll only be sustained performance for a very long time, where the laptop form factor can't sustain the thermal requirement, where you actually see a big hit there. So, like, and obviously in the MacBook Pro you get a screen and a keyboard and everything else as well. So I don't know what's going on with Mac Pro pricing. It just seems kind of insane that there's only $100 difference between the base config and the max config of the laptop, and you know, one's 256 gigabyte SSD and the other's 8 terabytes. Like,
yeah.
Your world's apart though.
Yeah, it's easier to understand the insane pricing for the Pro Display XDR because they're doing something that can cost a lot more, but they're doing it for a lot less. But it's still premium, so they can charge a lot for it, you know, like the $1,000 stand. But for the Mac Pro, it's much easier to compare just to their own lineup what you can get for the same money that makes it look out of whack. So yeah, but that's coming in December. So look, we'll have those. I think Jeff Benjamin wants to have one to review, but I'm not sure if he's yet convinced that he'll need it to keep around for work.
He seemed more interested in holding on to a 16-inch MacBook Pro.
Right, yeah. And the fact is, like, you don't need the Mac Pro to run the Pro Display XDR if you do spend the money for that. That MacBooks that already exist can do it, and then, of course, the 16-inch MacBook Pro can drive that as well. So, yeah, we've got a few more weeks, and then we'll see what Jeff does with that, and for how long.
Yeah, and I could be in the market for one of these. I don't know. I think
you were interested before, like the first leak started happening about what it will look like, at least.
Yeah, because I was ready for like a design change, right? And I thought that would be alongside the keyboard, and I was prepared to be like a $3,000 machine with a visual design change as well. But instead, we kind of got the same price, but the external design's kind of, you know, very similar. Like, I don't know. I think for the time being, I'm just gonna let my 15. I've survived with the Butterfly keyboard for 3 years. I might as well just keep going now. It's like, I want more visibility into like the ARM situation potentially coming, you know, early 2021 maybe. We'll probably find out more information about that next year. So yeah. I don't desperately need to replace the laptop. And for me, the, you know, like the chassis design was the incentive to do it, you know, to jump on it. And because it's not there, I think, I don't know. Like the fact that the pricing is actually decent is, you know, kind of swaying me. But
you did have a key fly off like a few weeks ago. So.
Right, I'm not joking. My keyboard is it's in dire straits here. But I feel like philosophically bad to buy the laptop again just to get the keyboard I should have got 3 years ago. So I don't know if I'm screwing myself over or I'm having, you know, sticking it to Apple. I don't know which way this equation's going, but I think I'm just going to hold on for a little bit longer.
Yeah, my decision would have been just immediate if it had an SD card slot, because I do use a camera that is in the iPhone a lot. And on the iMac Pro, I can pop it in the back, but on the MacBook Pro, I can't. I have to use the adapter. Even with iPhone and iPad, I can do that wirelessly pretty well, but I've not pulled it off on the Mac yet. And that's probably fiddly. But, so I just use the adapter, and there's plenty of space for an SD card slot. You know, a few years ago, Schiller addressed that by saying that using an SD card at all is cumbersome. And so they don't think that's the future, I guess. But this time in the Jonathan Morrison interview, he was asked again, and the answer was like more considered, I think, but it was just like, probably not ever going to return. for no good reason, but and there's been a pretty good discussion going on in the community lately, like since this has been released, about for so many of the things, they can be replaced with a USB-C with no adapter, but an SD card is not that way, that you've got to have a slot, that it's not something that you can really adapt, because you're like replacing old tech with it. I guess the closest thing to doing it the USB-C way is to have a USB-C cable, but then I don't carry one with my camera all the time, and I don't gotten used to that. It's just so easy.
It's definitely nicer to be able to pop the card out and put it in something versus putting a cable in both ends.
Yeah, and my routine is, like, if I'm at home, I'll just go back in the office and upload the photos from the SD card. I'm going to import them from the SD card on the iMac Pro and then have them upload to iCloud Photo Library, and then I'll look at them on the iPad or the iPhone that way, or even the MacBook, so...
I think if there was a time for Apple to reconsider its port situation, it was this machine.
Yes.
And they haven't done it, so it's not going to happen. The ship has 100% sailed.
Yeah. And lastly, I'll say, if resources were endless and money was no object, then I would find a way to offload the MacBook Pro and have the 16-inch, because I've got a 13-inch right now, have the 16-inch MacBook Pro, and then eventually have the Pro Display XDR, just because it's like the biggest, most modern looking Apple display, or only Apple display now, because those two can work together. But there's so much benefit in having an always on Mac at home, and the iMac Pro is still a great computer, and the MacBook Pro that I have now, the keyboard is annoying. I have to have it serviced soon, because it's in everything I type for a story, I have to go back and look to see if I have any double eyes that are unintentional. So that's a real nuisance. But it's also like what I have right now, it works for me, similar to you, even though yours is a few years older than all my stuff.
But, yeah, I really need, I need to like buy a laptop just to use it for a week so I can get my current one fixed and then return it, or I don't know.
Try the 16-inch, get your current one fixed, and then sell your current one.
Yeah.
that's what you do. That's what you will do.
We've all read some surprising online reviews, right? Whether you're trying to get a sweet deal on something you've been saving for, or trying to find the best happy hour in town, it's generally a good idea to read the reviews first. So why should finding the right software for your business be any different? Read thousands of real software reviews and find the right software for your business at Captera.com/happy hour. Not familiar with Captera? It's the leading free online resource to help you find the best software solution for your business. With over 1 million reviews of products from real software users, discover everything you need to make an informed decision. Search more than 700 specific categories covering the entire range of business needs, from project management, email marketing, even running your own yoga studio. No matter what kind of software you're looking for to get your business off the ground, or to simply optimize existing workflows, Captera makes it easy to discover the right solution, and fast. How'd you get started? Go to Captera.com and drill down into a subcategory like app design, home building, insurance, or banking. It's completely free to look around and explore what's available. Don't trawl the web with endless Google searches. Captera brings everything together into one simple-to-browse directory. Join the millions of people who use Captera each month to find the right tools for their business. Visit captera.com/happy hour for free today. Find the tools to make an informed software decision for your business. Captera.com/happy hour. That's spelled Captera, C-A-P-T-E-R-A. captera.com/HAPPYHOUR. Captera.com/happy hour. Captera, software selection simplified.
All right, Mayo, moving on from the MacBook Pro for this week at least, is some new news around sort of Apple and health and what they're doing with the research data, using in part the iPhone and in part the Apple Watch. And the first thing to come this week was that Stanford Medicine published the full results from their Apple Watch heart study, which was the first of its kind. I think Apple revealed this like back when the Series 3 watch was coming out, or maybe the Series 2, but it was like, we've got this and we're going to do research kit and we can do more of these that aren't just ours. But earlier this year, they published some findings from that study, the preliminary results. Now you can read the full results from that online. But separate from that, I guess a day later, they launched the research app that they announced back with the iPhone 11 and, yeah, and Apple Watch Series 5. And it's exactly what they promised to release. But now it's available. I've been able to use it in the US. You can't in the UK. But sort of summarize, what is this research app from Apple now?
Yeah, so if you're an iPhone owner and you have an Apple Watch, which is Series 1 or later, and you live in the United States, you can go and download the research app from Apple for free. And basically, at the moment, this is their new portal for research studies. Because when the original Apple Watch Heart Study came out, they had an app for that, but it was like very ad hoc on its own. Now they're kind of incorporating everything into this research app, and they're launching today with 3 studies and with a view to add more over time. And so we've got the 3 studies they have on offer is a women's health study, a heart and movement study, and a hearing study. Mm-hmm. And the names are pretty self-explanatory. One looks at women's health and menstrual cycles. You've got heart and movement for kind of extension of the Apple Watch heart study that they did before. And the hearing study uses like the noise app, decibel levels, to work out the impact of sound exposure on hearing health and stress. Because a lot of these things, like noise, like the noise is a good example, where scientists believe that, you know, loud noise can be bad for you in these 5 different ways, but they've never like had enough empirical evidence to kind of prove it for sure. And so with an app like, with a partnership with Apple like this, they can obviously collect data on, you know, hundreds of thousands of people that sign up, and the data can be collected automatically. You can get notifications for if you need to fill in little surveys over time and whatnot. And then, like the Apple Watch Heart Study, all the data gets shipped off to the partnering medical institutions, and they can crunch the numbers and come back with, you know, hypotheses and theories and results.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Apple built the software. They built the research app. They sponsor the surveys. Their hardware collects the data with your permission, and then it's real sort of medical institutes that do the real, like they interpret the data and they find, and this could be like what they point to in the future when they want to make a certain claim about the data. Yeah.
Yeah, like the noise, if you're exposed to high noise decibels, like we know that hurts your ears. What we don't know is what other adverse impacts that could have, like, and this report mentions like stress, for instance. Mm-hmm. They think there's a link between noisy environments and being overstressed, but the only way they know is to collect data on real people. And so this is what these kind of surveys facilitate.
Yep. From being able to download the app today, I did do the heart study before, but that was a separate app for the iPhone, and it had an app on the Apple Watch. I don't think that there's a research app for the Apple Watch, but of course they integrate with like the noise app, or they use data from the noise app on the Apple Watch Series 4 and later. And then
the App Store does show screenshots for a watch app.
Really? Maybe I just need to like go and toggle on the installation, and I haven't done that. But
I'll tell you what, I don't think you're missing much, because it basically just said how many tasks you completed and how many tasks you got left.
Sure.
So
yeah.
I don't think it's anywhere near as expansive as what the actual iPhone app offers.
Yeah, but they obviously use data from other apps on the Apple Watch, like the cycle tracking app, the noise app. And then I signed up for the heart and movement study so far, and that one wants you to work out with the workout app and then to try to use the ECG feature every now and then, sort of like when they, they'll like manually request that you do that sometimes. So, and also something I saw in signing up was that if you fall, they, if a fall is detected from the series 4 or series 5 through the heart and movement study, that they may want to do a follow-up call with you and sort of ask you questions about what happened, I think. So, it's neat how they have to have a human element to all of it. And it's not just here's raw data, figure it out, but they will have someone sort of in the middle, you know, get more information about it. And also they say with the heart and movement study, I think it caps out like 500,000 people. So it's not just everyone that wants to do it, but it's the first 500,000 who qualify. And then they want you to be committed to giving data for the next 5 years, which is kind of a long time, I guess, you know, for something like this, but it makes, you know, it's necessary. And then you've got to you have to give consent the first time you fill out some forms on your iPhone, but then they want you to renew that consent every 2 years. So even though it's 5 years, they don't want you to forget about it, and you've got to get permission to keep going with that. So, in the overall experience, like it's really easy to do, to go through the, you know, once you find the research app and install it and down, you know, it's really nice looking. I mean, it respects dark mode. So that's the way I saw it, was all in dark mode, and it looks as good as like the health app does in iOS 13. And you just go through and you answer some questions, and it didn't take long at all to sign up for the study. And then there were the two tasks that were possible right after that, which I think was to, commit to doing, using workouts, and then also commit to taking ECGs every now and then. So, it was really easy to do. I think I will go through the process of signing up for the noise study next. And then the women's health study. I don't qualify, obviously. So, but it's cool. And I'll be curious to see how many more of these they do. I think it's a really neat idea. It's not just an idea, but we've already seen in practice what they can do with the heart rate study in the Apple Watch. And then it's not just here's a way to give us data with the permission so we can research it and try to understand it and make some conclusions from it. But also, here's a published medical paper on everything that we learned from it and a conclusion. So I think
there's obvious ways for them to expand it, i.e. going international, right? They could partner with medical and hospitals in, you know, in Europe and the UK and stuff, and basically launch the same three studies, but for different, you know, populations.
Yeah, indeed. And they do ask you like demographic questions, including like, I tweeted out a screenshot of like one of the ones that made me feel a little bit uncomfortable, but it was like, I mean, you say things like, what are your education levels? Some things that, you know, will help them say, you know, if you don't have this level of education or this level of income, then your chances of having issues, you know, medically are higher. So they can draw conclusions like that. But one of them was like, it looks like a staircase, but they say, here's a ladder. And, do you feel, where do you feel like you are, in terms of education and income and just well-being? And you had to like pick where you are on the ladder, like highest, lowest, in the middle. And that was all the context, and anyone can answer anything. And so I felt like that one was a little bit weird, and that most people will probably answer kind of in the middle because they don't really know, that you feel like you're doing better than some people, but not as good as you could do. But there's more data than just like, you know, flip a button and now you can take my information. You got to do some human input to it as well, but it is all nicely done. And even if you don't read like word for word the consent forms, it's big text, it's scrollable, you can do it on your iPhone, you don't have to do it immediately, and then you just do a digital signature at the end to participate. So this was promised at the event in September, and now it's here. So I'm glad for that, and I'm definitely taking advantage of it. The 5 year thing, like for me, you know, I hope I'll still be using the iPhone and the Apple Watch, because if not, then they must have gotten really bad and something better has come along. But it did strike me as like 5 years. I don't know.
I mean, we survived 3 years with a terrible keyboard on the laptop.
That's true.
Time, we didn't jump ship then.
That's right. Time marches on, so it'll pass in no time.
The butterfly keyboard was actually an Apple Watch medical study. It was how much hate can the customer base endure while they still remain connected like, to our platform.
It looks like a Microsoft, like how bad is Windows? And that was another solution. Turns out more people went to like iOS and iPadOS than Windows.
That's funny.
Yeah, and that research isn't the only new thing this week. There's also this new Apple Music feature. not really part of the app, but part of the web app, and it's called Replay. And if you're familiar with Federico Vittici's shortcut, you know, previously guest workflow, but shortcut for finding sort of end of the year recaps of what you've listened to, how long, and like make like a PDF of all that. And so you can see not just like play counts, but like hours and albums and songs and genres and things like that. Now that's all built in as of this week. It's a bit of a beta feature, but tell me a bit about this and have you had a chance to play with it yet?
Yeah, so it's pretty cool. I think Apple Music in general is iterating at quite a fast pace with, you know, various changes, especially changes that they don't even need like software updates for. We saw obviously the changes to the, you know, For You screen to make it more personalized, and that's been rolling out, and they've been upgrading with their playlist, being more customized, more personal and more human. We saw live lyrics, and now what they've got is this thing called Apple Music Replay, which essentially takes your most listened to tracks over the year and compiles it into a playlist and shows you like top artists on the web view, top tracks, and you can even go back several years to see your account history and see your most played stuff from previous years. And Spotify has a feature like this. I think it's called Spotify Rewind that they kind of bring up near the holiday season so people can share it around on social media as the year ends. You know, it's like a New Year celebration thing. Obviously, Apple Music Replay is clearly inspired by that idea, though it is slightly different in that the Apple Music playlist will constantly refresh. So they say it's similar to your new music mixes. The Replay playlist will refresh on a weekly basis, so it can stay current with, you know, your music tastes, and it will just carry on throughout the whole year. And right now, you have to go to replay.music.apple.com and do it all through a web experience. There is a banner in the music app to make your replay, but when you tap it, it just takes you to Safari, and you have to log in anyway and do it through the website there. It's a nice UI and stuff, but, you know, it's a website. Hopefully, at some point, they will make this like integrated into the actual music app itself, and it'd be a lot nicer. It kind of feels like they came up on their end of year deadline to ship this feature, and they ran out of time, so they're like, okay, we'll just ship the web version, and then we'll work on the native integration at a later date.
Yeah, and doing this, I mean, I was the most surprised that it wasn't just for this year, but that there's back playlists of 2018, 2017, 2016, 2015. So all the data, and which is 2015 is when Apple Music launched, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so that's neat. And the fact that it will update weekly. So in 2020, like you mentioned, you'll have every week, it'll just be so far in 2020. And then by the end of the year, it's finalized. And then whatever you end on is like what the playlist is. But that's neat. But mine shows keeping track of all 1,150 hours of music you've listened to. So this year, this is hard work. So we did it. The songs you come back to in one playlist update weekly. So there's nothing surprising here from my results. It looks like what I listen to a lot. There are a few things that are weird, like you'll see things on here for like thunder sounds and things that, yes, I've played, but they're not really music. And now you've got the built-in ambient sounds on the HomePod, so that'll limit some of that. But I still do some of the albums for ambient sounds because they're better.
Some people were posting like, oh, their kids have taken over because the top songs are all just like the Frozen soundtrack or whatever.
Yeah. Mine's mostly me, from what I can tell. And we do family sharing, and so we've got different profiles on different devices. So that helps out a lot. But for example, like I've got 39 hours of nature sounds, and so that isn't really an album. But I guess I've listened to it on a literal, you know, basis. There's 32 hours of Kidz Bop Kids. That's real, but you know, obviously, like one thing you can do with family sharing is, you know, on the kids' devices, when they play music, it can be their library. But if you play music from your iPhone in the car, there's no way to say this is for the kids and not for me. Mm-hmm. So that's where that comes in. So it's pretty much like 32 hours of driving in the year. 81 different artists so far this year for artists, 114 different albums this year, and then they show top 10. So
you said 81 different artists and about 1,100 hours of music. Is that what you said?
81 different artists, 1,150 hours of music.
Mm-hmm. So mine is 567 hours of music, but 142 different artists.
Because
so,
you do those playlists where it's like top.
Yeah, I use a lot more of the pop workout playlists and stuff when I'm running. So obviously the music is rotating.
So each track is like an album, basically.
Yeah, essentially.
It's where it comes from, yeah.
I'm not sure if mine's fully working because some of the play, like on the website, it will show you the play counts. Mm-hmm. And my top play count is 37 plays. I'm sure I must have listened to some songs more than 37 times.
For like a song? Is play count?
Yeah, if you the top of the replay thing, it lists like your playlist, right? And mm-hmm. then on the right-hand side of the songs, it will say like 37 plays, 34 plays, 32 plays.
Yeah, my top 10 ranges from 121 to 60.
Yeah, I feel like mine must be close. Like, I feel like I must have listened to a song more than 37 times. Plus, I don't have any option to see previous years. And I've had Apple Music for a long time, so I'm not really sure what's going on there.
Yeah, and I can't see anything that I've brought into iTunes or Apple Music library on my own, which is...
Yeah, I think it's only stuff that's in the store.
Yeah, which is a number of things. So it can't be comprehensive in that regard, but that's understandable. I do hope that it factors in like where you play it from. Like if it surely it does, but if you play it from your watch or your phone, like it's all the same. I think that's the case here. Like I don't have anything I listen to on the watch more than I do from the phone, so I couldn't really tell in that regard. But
yeah,
so far so good. This looks cool. I haven't explored like last year in as much detail, but I'll see. So if I click on last year, I'll just do this in real time. You just get the playlist without all the information, it seems like.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
So you've got to be in this year and you get 100 songs, or I get 100 songs and it's 6 hours and 50 minutes of music. So that's for 2018. So you only get the cool information from the year that you're in, at least so far. Maybe now that they've released this in 2019, that in 2020 you'll see more detail for the previous years too.
Yeah, their biggest priority should be getting the actual interface inside of the app.
Like, put it in the iPhone. That's the exactly. Priority. Like,
priority iPhone native. Because at the moment, you click on the little banner and it takes you out to the website. Mm-hmm. And then you have to log in. So not only are you getting the rubbish, you know, web UI, you also have to log in again. Whereas you shouldn't, you know, you're on the music app on the phone. You shouldn't be forced to log in twice. But that's currently the situation because it just shoots you off to Safari.
Yeah. And this is pretty reflective of like what I listened to in high school too. So it's kind of timeless. 100 songs for each year. And that last one became 7 hours, 7.5 hours. So it just depends on the song length. But yeah, Apple Music Replay.
It's great they added it. And you do see Apple Music as the service overall moving at a pretty good clip, like in terms of feature improvements, and they're definitely not tied to the once a year cycle. Obviously, in this case, I think they got to close enough to the end of the year, and they were like, "Oh well, we just have to ship the web version. We don't have time to do the in-app integration." But you know, that's something for them to work on for 2020.
And I know everyone's already said Spotify did this way first. Okay. Well, there's a number of other reasons not to use Spotify, so, you know.
Spotify's this is just fine if you want to use Spotify, but, you know, if you're an Apple Music customer, it's nice for them to offer it too. Thanks to our friends at Smile Software for sponsoring Happy Hour. Text Expander is an incredible Mac productivity tool to have in your arsenal. Make everything you write repetitively available everywhere you type. Text documents, spreadsheets, web forms, and more. Turn the things you type into reusable snippets to access them time and time again. Text Expander goes beyond simple find and replace. With variables and forms, snippets are much more powerful. You can quickly stamp out an invoice with easily editable fields to change only the bits that need to be customized for each individual client. Text Expander is applicable to so many situations. Email addresses, signatures, chunks of code, hard-to-remember names, form letters, anywhere that you need consistent and accurate text. If you've ever written something twice, there's a good chance you could work smarter using a Text Expander snippet instead. For instance, if you're a developer who does live presentations, you can use Text Expander to store bits of code and avoid embarrassing mistakes by letting Text Expander insert the code snippets into your IDE as you concentrate on the core message of your presentation. Text Expander is available for macOS, iPhone, iPad, Windows, and Chrome. And for Mac users upgrading Catalina, don't sweat. Text Expander is ready and working. Text Expander for Teams adds a whole extra layer for coordinating work with others. Snippets can be shared automatically across the organization. You can manage which members of your team have access to different snippets with Text Expander groups, And you can even see statistics about which snippets are being used more than others, so you can focus on tuning up any areas of your business that are being ignored. Companies use Tech Expander for Teams for customer support, reporting, and much, much more. Shared snippets unify your organization's voice. Unlock your productivity with Tech Expander. Listeners to this show can get 20% off their first year subscription. Visit textexpander.com/podcast to learn more and sign up. That's textexpander.com/podcast.
All right, Mayo, this week we've got news on Apple's sort of long-awaited bundle. They've never announced anything about bundling their services yet, but it does seem like something that they will inevitably have to do if they want to keep growing the number of subscribers. And we saw like a little whiff of this a few weeks ago, and I think it was the Financial Times who had reported that some participants that would be involved in this were unhappy with what the terms would be like. And now there's a new development from by way of Bloomberg about what they're doing here. So what's the change this time?
Yeah, so none of these reports definitely confirm that they're going to do a bundle. It's still in the hedging phase of Apple's considering this or considering that. What this news is from Bloomberg is that the terms for publishers participating in Apple News include concessions for if the News Plus subscription is bundled. So obviously, if you just buy it, it's $9.99 a month, and Apple takes half of it for themselves, and then the other half is distributed amongst all the magazines that have been read and the newspapers that have been read in the service for that month based on usage. So if you've got a 50-50 split, if you go to a bundle model, the allocation of the money for News Plus will be less than $9.99 a month, which means the publishers will be getting less money per customer split, you know, divided up. And so the contracts include affordances for that to be possible. So Apple can already use News Plus in a bundle if they want to. Whereas what we heard with the Financial Times was that it sounded like that rule or line of the contract was not currently in the music label's contract with Apple for Apple mm-hmm. Music. So they're on the negotiating table trying to get something like that weaved into it, which would allow them to, you know, reduce the overall price. Because for Apple News, they have to give money to the content, ultimately, right? The people that make the magazines and the newspapers. For Apple Music, they have the music labels, the artists, the songwriters, all of that stuff, which is all very, very tightly controlled. And if you look across music streaming, everyone essentially charges the same price for everything.
Yeah.
It's basically been industry standardized.
Yeah, I did a column for when I do a weekly tech column for my Sydney Super Clarion Ledger, and I thought it would be more interesting than it ended up being, but it was like comparing the different music services, and the only differences were in what they do for like bundle prices. You know, the base plan and the family plan for every service is $10 and $15. There's no difference on any of them, with few exceptions, unless it was for other reasons, like your military or you're a first responder, you know, or you're a student, and those were different. But yeah, they're standardized.
So,
yeah,
exactly. So what Bloomberg says is that Apple is looking or exploring ways that they could bundle Music, News Plus, and TV Plus together as soon as 2020. So it sounds like, you know, Apple's not just like waving in the wind. They're looking to do this, but it doesn't like nail down specifics. It particularly says including Music, News Plus, and TV Plus. So theoretically, they could throw other stuff into the bundle as well, like Apple Arcade potentially, or maybe they're going to go beyond just content services and do, you know, iCloud and stuff in there as well. It's not clear yet where they're heading, but if they want to offer a bundle that's actually, you know, of a decent discount, they just don't want to lose money on everything, so they have to negotiate with their content partners to get it down. And so it sounds like they have leeway with News. They're working on getting some leeway with Music, although we don't know how well that's going to go. For TV Plus, obviously, they control all the content there, and they can pay themselves whatever they want, you know, within reason, because
right.
You have to make profit at some point, right? But they could theoretically zero rate TV Plus and just carry on, which is exactly what they have done with Apple Music student subscriptions, because you can get TV Plus and Apple Music as a student for $4.99 a month, which is $4.99 a month, and all of that money's just they just pay the music label, is always what they did for the students, is for the student plan, and they just take TV Plus as a freebie. It also says in the Bloomberg article that Apple news partners, some of them have been happy, others have been less than pleased with the performance of the service. We saw an article from CNBC today that Apple News Plus essentially quickly got about 200,000 subscribers when it launched back in March, but is essentially flat in the, you know, 7 months,
it's 8 months. No material change, right?
Mm-hmm. And in the Bloomberg article, they don't name the publication, but they say that this group was in Texture before they came to News Plus, mm-hmm. and this publication made more money when Texture was a thing than when News Plus was a thing.
That's fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Which is kind of bad.
Yes.
but Texture was multi-platform, so maybe the Android difference makes up the change there. You don't know, right? But and to be fair to Bloomberg, they also quote the LA Times that say the financial returns from News Plus are consistent with their expectations. So it could be a mixed bag. It certainly doesn't sound like News Plus is doing, you know, gangbusters miles better than what Texture did. Maybe it's at equilibrium, and when a service goes from being some random third-party thing to being integrated into the stock, you know, number one news app on the iPhone, you'd expect it to have better performance than it seemingly has been doing. The Bloomberg report quotes sources that say Apple is committed to developing the news product over time. They're not going to drop it or anything. But it definitely seems like at least some parties are a bit disgruntled with the initial reception. And the promise of a bundle may keep parties on board. Because one interesting caveat is that apparently, via Bloomberg, the contracts for news mean that a magazine or a newspaper can leave after a year if they're not satisfied with the situation. Mm-hmm. And so Apple News Plus launched in March, and we're currently in November, so by March 2020, there could be an exodus of magazines that aren't happy with the returns that they're getting. So they pull out.
Yeah, so they started with around 300 magazines. I think that was the claim. I think it was closer to like 280 or 90 or so. But if one pulled out, it would probably be much more than that, because that 300 number is because one publisher owns a bunch of different, you know, names. And, you know, there's a lot that's kind of just filler in there, stuff that's like just like a PDF and not actually an experience. But for me, like, if News Plus would add, if they could make a deal with the New York Times to add them, that would make it more compelling. Just like that one change, you know. And they haven't yet. And so I hope that they're really trying to do that, because they've got the Wall Street Journal and they've got the LA Times, but they even kind of like...
Yeah, and they've got a pretty big English newspaper in the Times as well, which is not like a small...
That helps in the UK.
They're one of the leading newspapers in Britain.
Yeah, that helps in the UK. I mean, WSJ is huge too, but you want to have New York Times and Washington Post to be complete, it seems like. And because they have LA Times, like, I wonder why they don't have more other like regional papers, because we look at... New York Times is national, Washington Post is national, Wall Street Journal is national, LA Times is as well. But they kind of pitch them as like the most relevant in terms of like entertainment news, you know, because of the location, which makes sense. But if they could have Washington Post and New York Times, and it would feel like a complete package, and for $10 a month, it'd be like, just for that alone, who cares about the magazines? You're getting all of these newspapers for this price.
Yeah, honestly... News Plus might be a better deal if they just got rid of all the magazines and only made it about newspapers.
Yeah, I saw someone on Twitter today like reply to me about something, and they were like, I don't care about News Plus because all news is bad news. It's like, you actually do get a lot of stuff that's just like most of it is magazines. And there was that reference to it where it was called Apple. What was it called? Apple News Magazines before?
It was literally called Apple News Magazine.
Yeah, not Plus. But that alone would be huge, and obviously they haven't been able to achieve that yet, and also Wall Street Journal could leave if they wanted to. But in terms of the app experience itself, they've made some pretty good improvements with just how you use the app and how you can see like what are you actually following, what do you care about versus what's the full catalog there, and the ability to view back issues of content is important too. So I've subscribed and left and come back. I've not had a subscription since March. I've probably subscribed for about 4 months total, not consecutively. So, right now I'm in, but I will say, like, leaving is no problem. Obviously, it's more like my favorite experience with News Plus is on the iPad Pro, like a magazine, which we talked about when this first service first came out. I was like, that's where it shines. And, you know, it's always in like leisure time. You know, it's never like, you know, this is something I can do in line, but it's like at home. If I've got some leisure time, I watched some TV and like read some magazines, and that was kind of cool. But yeah, it would be more of a go-to thing if they had New York Times and Washington Post, and then even just more newspapers from other country. That would be compelling.
Yeah, but dismal results are not going to appease get the newspapers on board. It's almost playing out what they thought, that they wouldn't get enough return from it.
Yeah, so. And they're having enough trouble right now being profitable and not losing money. So
yeah, so there is a catch-22 situation there. Yes. And maybe the bundle is a way for Apple to boost and make the publishers more happy, because even though they'd be getting less money per user, presumably you could attract more than 200,000 people to sign up to a big Apple bundle, because you'd also be pulling them from music and TV and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then the news is just kind of flowing there on the side, versus, you know, paying as News Plus as a separate entity. And that might be an argument that they take to the publishers when March rolls around. They're like, you know, don't leave us yet. We might be able to swell up, you know, millions of subscribers on a bundle package that will, you know, funnel down to money to you that you're not getting today. The bundle situation, it's yet to be seen. Like, we don't know. The problem is hard to evaluate at the moment, because we don't know, like, what kind of price they're targeting or whatever. Because right now, if you did music, family, TV, and news, individually, it'd be, you know, $30 a month. But news isn't very compelling. So for me, I'm not paying for news. I'm only paying $20 a month. And at the moment, I get a year free of TV Plus anyway, but ignoring that. So if you were just paying for it, it would be Apple Music Family, which is $15. And TV, which is $5, so that makes $20. So even if they bundled the three together and gave a $10 discount, I'd be like, well, whatever. That's what basically what I pay today anyway, so it wouldn't make a difference. If they only give you $5 off, like they say you get TV Plus for free, well, then I wouldn't buy it, because I'm not interested in news as it stands today anyway, and
sure,
I wouldn't want to pay $25. So if they're only going to offer a combo of those three, you know, and they're not going to go to $15, right? Because then you're just putting all of your amount of money into music and then giving people two extra services for free, which doesn't really make much sense. Like,
right.
The leeway they have is predominantly in the $5 of TV that they can zero rate and make that essentially zero, right? And yes, they're negotiating with the news people and the music people to bring the numbers down a bit, but they're not going to like cut it in half. It's just unrealistic. You might get like $2 off on news, so it goes from $50, because if you do, you know, $9.99 divided by 2, that's 5. So maybe you can get the publishers to accept $3 of every share, and then maybe on music you can get like a $1 or $2 movement, but you're not going to have like Apple Music Family go from $15 to $9.99. like, we've seen the state of the industry, the music companies are at bleeding edge. They're not going to want to go to, they're not going to compress their, you know, their income streams that much.
Yeah, so, I think that any deal that like Apple gets down, that Spotify is entitled to the same terms too.
Yeah,
for music at mm-hmm. least.
So, mate, I don't think just a three-service deal is really tenable, because they don't have much room to play with. If they add in, you know, arcade as well, then that's also something where they basically, because they have to pay the game publishers for arcade, but I don't think it's based on, you know, it's not strictly connected to usage per se, so they probably have more leeway there and what they can do. But again, you know, arcade's only $4.99 on its own, so it's like, it almost feels like you're going to have to throw in like iCloud or something to actually make the number compelling. But that's all stuff that's very much up in the air, and we can't really analyze it yet until we get a clearer picture of what they're going for.
Yeah, iCloud is a big chunk of what I pay each month, because I pay for the 2 terabyte plan, and it works with family sharing, so everyone gets to benefit. But just for me alone, having photos and documents in iCloud, I need to have more than the plan under that, which I think is, what is it, 200 or 500 gigabytes? So I think it's 200.
Yes, 200.
Yeah. So and I'm, you know, I've evaluated whether I should keep it or find a way around that in the past, and I am living with that $10 a month plan. And I could even see a situation where I hope they have more than 2 terabytes. And if they had a higher price, I'd be stuck with that too. But, it's such a service that I rely on that keeps all my, like, my devices running and everything that I am all in on that. And sort of related to iCloud in this way is that just today there was news that Logitech Circle 2 cameras are the first to work with HomeKit Secure Video, which is another sort of service related thing because it's included with 2 terabytes and 200 gigabytes of iCloud storage. So you do have to pay for that. It just doesn't take up your space in the cloud for that. But all of these features like are getting rolled in. So for me, yeah, like you, it needs to incorporate iCloud space to be compelling because the music bundle is already really good for family. I mean, that's a really good deal there. But like,
you know, yeah, and to be fair, maybe we're not the target audience, right? Cause we're, you know, well deep down the rabbit hole of giving Apple money. So maybe it's attracting people that are currently only on the $9.99 individual Apple Music plan.
Sure.
And maybe if they could double, like, you're essentially seeing what they can throw in to double their monthly spend from 10 to 20, right? And then if they go, oh, you can have family Apple Music and you can have TV and you can have the new service. And then, so maybe that will encourage people to go to 20, whereas before they were like, oh, I'm only paying $9.99 for music and nothing else.
Yeah. And for music, I could see them saying, the bundle is only for individuals paying month to month and not for individuals paying annually or for families. So if you've got I guess it's useful that arcade and TV and news are the same rate whether you're an individual or a family. But for Apple Music, it's an individual rate and a family rate. So it's not all included. You know, it's $10 to $15. But for to go annually, you can go annually with TV Plus from, what is it, $5 a month to $50 a year?
Yeah, it's $50 a year. So you get 2 months free, basically.
Right. And with Apple Music, you can go from $10 a month to $100 a year as an individual. You don't get the deal.
Which is also 2 months free, I've just realized.
Exactly, right. Yeah. And so if you ignore annual plans, then you've got some more leeway with what you can do with a month-to-month bundle, and that it could be that the bundle is kind of like going annual but paying month-to-month. You know, so there's some room to play right there too. But yeah, it's the one thing that I think that I was certain on with the bundle situation before TV Plus launched and Arcade launched is that there's no way that they would launch the service with a bundle up front, that they'd want to save the bundle pricing for when they want to grow the audience from what they can like peak at. And you want to sell it for as much as you can for as long as you can before you start giving away stuff. And, you know, the annual plan
that has played out.
Yeah, that has played out. The annual plan for TV Plus was a surprise, but also so was 1 year free of service. And that won't continue on beyond the first year for most people. I mean, it's a limited situation. And it's also true for the free TV Plus with Apple Music. And I think it's maybe just related to the service that they go through to verify that you're in college working toward a degree, but it maxes out at 48 months. So you don't get, you know, you can't, if you keep going to school, you can't keep getting that rate. So,
And they do have asterisks that the free TV Plus is limited time only anyway, so they could remove it at some point.
Exactly,
just,
right.
You just go back to having music only.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the thing with them, you know, you get the TV bundle with the 1 year free, like the quasi hardware bundle, right, where you get TV free for a year. At the moment, that's not going to stack, and it won't renew. And the next time you buy a piece of hardware, you don't get another year. They have a lot of levers to play with. Like when next September rolls around, if they want to, they could say, you know, you buy a new Apple device and you again get another year to play with, right? The deal as it stands today could change depending on their situation. So if they're not happy with the amount of TV Plus people they've got on board by this time in September, they could just, you know, hit the reset button and say, well, if you buy another new Apple device, you can get another year of TV Plus for free, and they can just do it again if they want to, even though the current rules don't allow that, you know. Terms and conditions are subject to change, so they can change it however they want.
Yeah, they can limit it to just iPhones and not include the Apple TV or the iPad, you know, if they wanted to.
So yeah, and regarding the bundle, it definitely seems like something that would, if it does happen, it would be like a September thing, right? Like a full unveiling, because then they can do it alongside the phones, and this time next year, the Apple TV Plus content library will be more built out.
That's like, true.
I felt like if they did it, you know, in March, it'd be a bit like, well, whatever. Because because the thing is, if you do it in March, you're still having loads of people getting 3 years of TV Plus anyway. So
that's true.
It's like you're on a you kind of have to wait out the 3 year situation. So if they are going to do a big bundle, then it would in my head, I'd be thinking like September timeframe. And there's no guarantee that they will do a big bundle just because they're getting these leeways signed into the contracts. They could just start doing mini bundles where you can get two services for $2. Like if you do TV Plus and music, then you get $2 off or something. Like It doesn't have to be a thing where they throw everything in one big pot. That's just, you know, what people expect them to do based on like Amazon Prime and stuff. But as we talked about before, Amazon Prime isn't profitable. So it seems like something that Apple's not going to, you know, just copy Amazon Prime straight up because they want to make money off this thing. So that you could see situations where you get, if you have Apple Music already, you can add TV Plus on for $3 extra, not $5. Versus a situation where the only bundle is, you know, you have to get four services and you get $5 or $10 off or whatever. So there's a lot of different axes on which they can operate here.
Yeah, I know people have a lot of ideas about what a bundle could be for them. Like, for example, if you use the iPhone upgrade program, that should be a factor. Like anything you can pay Apple monthly for, people want to be like one payment on one date for one amount. And because you're all in, give me a perk for that, you know, tie in with Apple Card. I mean, you get 3% there, that helps out. But there's so many things that they could do. And not to mention, like, what if they do a new service with podcast, or, you know, what if they do something else? So we'll see on that. There's other news in the TV Plus space this week, including some personnel change. So the one big one for me that we'll talk about is that AT&T bought HBO through a bigger purchase for AT&T, and they basically ran the management out of town. Like, people that have been there for years are like, okay, I'm out now. And they've got AT&T people in charge now, and they're going to run HBO differently. And that left the former CEO of HBO available, like looking for something new created to do besides like program for HBO, like lead HBO. And so now he is rumored to be talking to Apple about a TV deal now, right?
Yeah. So he's apparently starting up his own production company. Richard Pepler is his name. And He obviously heralded HBO through the golden years of like Game of Thrones and stuff and Silicon Valley. And like, he's got a lot of respect and reputation in the television industry. And it sounds like now that he's been, you know, he's departed HBO, he wants to go back to just doing like, you know, a smaller scale TV production. And the current deal that's apparently being discussed is he would produce, you know, shows and movies exclusively for Apple. So Apple would be his only client with his, you know, with his production company.
That would be a big deal.
That would be a big deal. Like, with, you know, even I'd argue he's a bigger name than J.J. Abrams even. Right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, he turned HBO into like a household name, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's really interesting. I hope that pans out, because that will make people respect Apple TV Plus a lot more than they do now. They'll take it much more seriously, which can have a number of effects, you know, both in what they can.
Like all of the big shows you associate with HBO were basically done under his leadership. True Blood, Newsroom, Silicon Valley, Game of Thrones, like Veep, like all those things are such like big franchises, and they all came under his remit. Really.
And
so,
he has experience on Apple events. It was the HBO Now, which is like before you had HBO as a premium channel that you paid your cable or satellite subscription provider for monthly. Then there was HBO Go, which is the app that you can have on your iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, or the website, and you can sign in with your TV credentials. And then the big thing was HBO Now is the standalone channel that is an app that you can pay monthly for. I think it's $15 a month. And he was at the Apple event to unveil that alongside like what a price change to the Apple TV.
Was back when the Apple TV was $69.
Yeah, it was the third generation
box.
That was
the good years.
Right, and not 150, 180, 200. It's a big story. You know, it's nothing to announce yet from them, but it is at least in the works, and it makes so much sense. Apple has the money, and he has the interest. So that's from the Wall Street Journal. And there was another change in personnel this week, someone who left Apple to go to production. Is that right?
Yeah. So a guy called Kim Rosenfeld, who was the head of current programming at Apple TV Plus, basically since its inception. Jamie Ehrlich and Zach Van Amberg, once they left Sony and they joined Apple, they poached a lot of their top Sony people to come with them. And Rosenfeld worked with Sony and Ehrlich before, mm-hmm. so he came across and actually led the programming for TV Plus's launch. So basically all the shows that you've heard today that aren't documentaries and like nonfiction stuff, all of those kind of shows, like all of the launch shows, all of the, you know, 30, 40 shows that are in production at the moment all came under his heraldship. Apparently, as TV Plus launched, he left the company and now they've got some other people doing, working on it. Or the people that were there before have just been promoted to work on it. There was some consternation that this was like, oh, TV Plus launch must have gone really badly. The critics' review sucked, so he got fired. Like, I mean, you could see it that way. I don't really think that's the case. Like, you know, you had critics at the time that he left the company. You had critics' reviews for four shows.
Yeah,
right. He signed off on like 30
for a few episodes of four shows. Yeah,
for a few episodes of four shows, and he signed off on like 5 times, 10 times more than that. Mm. Plus, it's not like he was a random hire they got from. They didn't know before. They knew what they were getting into. When Ehrlich and Amberg hired him, they'd already been working with him before at Sony. So it's not like, you know, they clearly had a friendship and rapport that went back a long time. I think it's highly unlikely that he left because of, you know, performance reasons. It sounds like to me that he was like retiring from, you know, being part of management, and he's going back to what his roots are, which is, again, in production of making shows, kind of similar to what Pepler's doing.
Right, from HBO. So I think the TV Plus chain of command is sort of like Tim Cook at the top, then Eddie Q below him, and then Jamie and Zach report to Eddie. Is that right?
Yeah.
And then this person reported to Jamie and Zach. It's like a, mm-hmm. like, so it isn't like he, like, it's different than Jamie and Zach leaving, and it's different than TV Plus being moved from Eddie Q to like Schiller or something, which we've seen with apps or other things. It's just that someone near the top has built it, and now they're gone. And
they seem to be leaving amicably because he's agreed a first look deal with TV Plus anyway. So his production company will show what they produce, their pitches and stuff, first to Apple to give them like first refusal, essentially.
Yeah, so, which Apple has with other producers. Now he'll be one of those.
Yeah, so it doesn't sound like a train wreck situation, time to fire people and switch it up. I mean, we've already talked about on this episode about the News Plus launch being mediocre, and we haven't heard of any massive firings from there. Like, I don't think that's really how Apple plays this a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Like, you have exceptions. You have, you know, like the you have the Broward cases of like Apple retail and stuff. But in general, Apple looks at a lot of long-term situations, and, you know, they're committed to improving the news product. They're committed to continue to make TV programs. And I don't think it's like they're not going to knee-jerk get rid of someone just because, you know, their first week of shows are bad.
Yeah,
like, maybe if it had been 2 years in the running and the critical acclaim for TV Plus was still bad, then you could have more of an argument for it. But, you know, 1 week in is just unrealistic.
Yeah, this person's their timeline has been that they worked with Jamie and Zach at Sony, and then Apple poached them, so that then they poached teammates from Sony. And so that was a big career change, going from Sony to building this whole new thing for Apple. And then that gets launched, and then, you know, maybe there is a creative itch, or there's like a realization that there's even more money in production side. And it's like, I've been working with all these people that do something I can do, and now I can do that on my own now, like I've done before. So yeah, it seems like just something that was natural to happen. And then how have you been enjoying Disney Plus over there in the UK?
I've been loving it. At least we got a date this week.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, March 31st, 2020.
That's just around the corner of the corner.
Only like 5 months away, but at least we got a date.
Yeah, good luck not being spoiled by any shows in the meantime.
Yeah, that is kind of awkward, where, like, obviously loads of people want to watch The Mandalorian, but if you're not in the US or the Netherlands, where new Disney Plus is launched.
Or Canada.
Or Canada, yeah. Sure. But if you're a European like me, there's no way for you to watch The Mandalorian at the moment until March 31st.
Without piracy.
No legal way to do it anyway.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's too bad for you. So on, I was really excited for Disney Plus, and it's cool. I managed to get through like I wanted to get caught up on Apple TV Plus because you can. The catalog is not big enough yet that there's like Netflix level of just content that you're never going to want to care about. So I saw all four of C, all what, like 8 or 10 or 12 of Dickinson.
Yeah, Dickinson's 10.
Yeah, and I enjoyed that. It delivered. All four of For All Mankind that are out so far, all four of The Morning Show. I watched the Elephant Queen documentary, which I had like low expectations for being of interest to me. But man, like the closeness of the animals and things that they followed, it was just cool to see. Like, and it was really beautiful on my TV. It was a little bit sad at some parts though. But and then I saw three of Snoopy in Space, and the thing that they're 8 minutes long, and there's enough episodes for that to be 96 minutes. But some of those minutes are used by the opening part, and then some of those are used for the credits, so it's even shorter than that. But the inability to consistently skip through the trailer or the opening, and the like flickiness of the next episode being the next episode. Like, I do see that tray pop up on the TV sometimes where you can click and go to the next one. But a lot of times I had to like go back and find it. So
yeah, it doesn't always show up.
Yeah. So for what could be a 90 minute movie of Snoopy and his journey to the moon, and beyond, I would have finished it in one sitting, but I could only do three before I was like distracted by something else and need to come back. But
yeah, I think they are doing more episodes, they're just not out yet.
Right, same for Helpsters. So that's which the kids have started Zero Quest by name now, so they know what it is and what it's about. Although that was before Disney Plus came about. So Disney Plus, the first thing I'll say on Disney Plus is that I really wish it was an Apple TV channel. There's no reason we would expect it to be one, because that requires some revenue split with Apple. But that would mean, though, that you can use the Apple TV app anywhere the Apple TV app is provided, whether it's your iPhone, iPad, Mac, Apple TV, Samsung TV, LG TV coming soon, Sony, Vizio TV, all those places. Then you could subscribe through that and then watch it, because it streams from Apple's servers and not Disney's. So they've got the content wherever their app is. That would be really cool. And the benefit there would be you've got family sharing. So it's up to six people could have access to the service. So that would be neat. But it's not a TV channel yet. It does integrate with
the TV. They do let you sign up with in-app purchase though. So they're happy to give Apple some money.
Yeah. They've got a different set of rules for how many people can view at the same time. So I think with family sharing, I don't know, but surely it's each member could view at the same time.
Yeah. You get six streams. You get six simultaneous streams.
Okay. For Disney Plus, it's four. So.
But you can have seven user accounts on Disney Plus.
Yeah, you can have more users, but you can only stream on the four devices at the same time. So that would be, they'd be giving more away with TV. But that is a channel, but that would be cool. But it does work with the TV app, and it was confusing at first, because at first they weren't promoting it yet, because it was like just getting out the door, you know, like it launched in the middle of the morning. But then like by day two, they're promoting the TV Plus content or Disney Plus content in the TV app pretty heavily. But once you open, you could open the Disney Plus app, and then you just like, that's what it is, and you can set it up and you can use it. But I think it requires going in the TV app before it was loaded with a bunch of content. You had to find something in Disney Plus and open it in that way to give permission to connect the two. And I did go through the process this week of like disconnecting Hulu, because it was everything we watched was like in the up next list. It was like one episode that we'll never watch again. But now it's just T Plus and HBO Go that I get through my AT&T plan, and then and Disney Plus. So it's not a whole lot in terms of like what the up next queue will be because of how it connects. But I went through the process in Disney Plus of like doing. They have their own watch list where you hit a plus button and then it adds something to your watch list. I did that for a lot of shows. And then I realized it sounds like an Apple fan thing, but I realized that as okay as the Disney Plus user interface is, I think it's too dense, just like Amazon Prime Video is, where you've got too many titles on the screen at one time, and they could be larger and less dense and it'd feel better. But at any rate, I did enjoy once the TV app from Apple got populated with Disney Plus content, browsing there and then adding stuff to the up next list is like that, like having that as like my watch cue and not Disney's, because they, those don't connect, you know, you can do it in one app and I just go to the other one, but just putting things in that lineup of Up Next. I found a lot of stuff that isn't just the new original content. Like I watched The Mandalorian. We're mostly through the live action version of Lady and the Tramp. And, but the, because Disney Plus is also Marvel and Star Wars, I have all those purchased through iTunes, but they're not in 4K HDR because they're HDR, but they're not in 4K because Disney hasn't let those be upgraded for free like other studios have. So now I can watch those in the highest quality possible on my TV, which is nice. But I've also bought those and there's some things missing. Like you can't get, the Spider-Man movies from Marvel because they belong to, Sony, and you can't get the original Hulk because it belongs to like Universal Studios. So there's some weird things there. And they even show like movies like, the Marvel Avengers movie before Endgame, Infinity War. I don't think they have that yet from Netflix. So it's like you can watch the ending of that movie, but not the first half of the movie. They show like it's like coming next year sort of thing. But what I've enjoyed the most is the stuff from, what is it? Nat Geo, National Geographic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of it. And there's just so many like documentaries that I didn't get a chance to see when they aired or, you know, I didn't know about. And that I populated my Apple TV app with that stuff. So I can't watch it on my Samsung TV yet in the bedroom because there's not a Disney Plus app there yet. And I think that would be like the TV app where it requires a firmware update versus like submitting it to their app store just because of how it works. I could AirPlay it, but I don't like doing that for video content because then so many ways it can get interrupted. But I've very much enjoyed like using the Apple TV app to navigate and find content. And if you look at it now, it's just full promotions for Disney Plus. And if you look at the trending stuff, like, you know, on the Apple TV, they have that gray app icon with the magnifying glass for search.
Yeah.
And it's like trending TV shows and trending movies. It's like two rows. It's all Disney Plus stuff right now. Like I saw one thing that wasn't Disney Plus, and because it's Disney Plus, like, part of the pitch there is a bunch of the back catalog stuff. None of it's new. It's just all stuff from like the 80s and 90s and 2000s from Disney Plus. So it's taken over that search box. But yeah, just going from the TV app to, you know, it launches you back into the Disney Plus app. It works okay. I mean, we've been used to that for a long time with other services. So it would be much nicer if it was an Apple TV channel. Maybe in the future they'll do that. But for now, it's a good service. I paid for the first year, so you don't get the free year like you do with TV Plus from Apple. But unless you're a Verizon 4G or 5G cellular customer with an unlimited data plan, I believe, or if you sign up for at home, I think it's Fios or 5G at home service, then you can get a free year. But otherwise, it's, what is it? $7 a month or $70 a year? So I did the pay for the year up front thing and save some money. But yeah, all these services coming together. But I mean, like Zoom way out, and it really makes the Apple TV feel like it's gone from kind of getting boring to where the first couple of tiles at launch were like iTunes movies and iTunes TV shows. And now you've got the TV app, not just as like an aggregator of content, but also as like its own service. And there's even more services that you can enjoy on the TV. So I like this. I like this change.
You can't deny the Disney Plus service is very compelling for what you get.
Like, yeah.
$6.99 a month and you get, you know, basically massive brands like Marvel and Nat Geo and everything. Like,
yeah.
It's clearly like a destination app. Like you have all these streaming services, and you have obviously the leader at the moment is Netflix. You have Disney Plus, which seems to be odds on the closest competitor to Netflix anytime soon, right? Just because it has the massive library and it has the big names that people want with all the, you know, all the superhero movies, all of Mickey Mouse, all of that stuff. And then you have, you know, everyone else. TV Plus, CBS, HBO, all with the kind of more niche areas. Like the only apps I'd really call like true destinations are Netflix and Disney, just because their catalogs are so big at the moment. Everyone else is still, you know, ramping up or only doing originals like Apple is. So it's hard not to put Netflix and Disney as number one and number two at the moment. And then everyone else is trying to work out, you know, fighting for who's actually going to take the third spot. mm-hmm. really.
Yeah. And with Apple TV channels where you can subscribe through the TV app, stream it in the TV app, don't fiddle, mess with another app for that service. Because there are times where a show that you care about releases or like is in season, then it's really easy to subscribe to Showtime for a few months as you watch a new show come out every week, or after it's all out, like subscribe and just like binge it. That helps a lot. And also because of like TV Plus and Disney Plus have some similarities where if you ignored the back catalog of shows, like there's all the Marvel and Star Wars stuff. If you don't already own that, then that's really compelling. And then some recent Disney stuff. But like, if you don't care about the stuff from the 20s through 80s, which is a bunch of the catalog, or a bunch of like the 90s, the shows that you watched in the 90s and 2000s, then you narrow it down to the original content. If you compare their original content, it's pretty limited for now. They have big plans over the next several years of what they'll do with Marvel content and Star Wars content and new Disney content. But you can watch The Mandalorian. There's a documentary about Disney in general. It's like an hour and a half long. There's, I think, a weekly Marvel Heroes show. That's pretty short, but there's not a whole lot. There's a Nat Geo original show, but there's not a whole lot of like stuff you can only get from Disney Plus that you couldn't get elsewhere. That's original. So, and those, they're releasing them similar to Apple. Like with The Mandalorian, you can watch the first episode, but I guess in a week's time, the next episode
it's
comes
every
out.
Friday, The Mandalorian now. So you get a new episode tomorrow and then it's weekly.
Okay. Yeah. So they're doing like Apple and there's only 8 of those. So it won't last but beyond 2 months, but for the first season at least. So
yeah, I think what Disney's announced is 25 originals next year, mm-hmm. which would essentially match what Apple's going to do because they're going to do about 30 roughly. So yeah. At least for year one, the difference is obviously Disney's originals will have their intellectual property with, the big superhero stars.
It helps that they're not having to create things from scratch, right?
Yeah, nobody knows what C is until it existed. So that you can have the celebrity faces, but the actual characters are, have to be brought up from ground zero. Yeah. Whereas
the way Apple,
have a big advantage in that regard.
Yeah, the way Apple sort of articulated that is that they have great stories from names you trust. So they're not doing a bunch of stuff with new actors, and they're not saying this is how you're going to discover the next generation of actors. They're relying on talent that you already know. I mean, it's really easy to look at who they use and where they're from. That's where you can recognize them versus Disney's IP. But it's cool. And it's those two, we do Netflix, but we do Hulu, but the main thing I care about in Hulu is it's like some football, but then mostly local news. And I wish you could just pay for local news and that's all. Because I'm paying $45 a month for that through Hulu mostly. It doesn't feel great. I don't want to do an antenna and things like that. So I've not yet settled how I will do that without just kind of giving it up. But
See yourself ever giving up on Netflix?
Oh, totally. I haven't opened Netflix in so long. I've relied on watching Netflix at other people's houses, not because I'm going to, but if I'm visiting my mom and she's watching something on Netflix, then that's when I see it. But I haven't paid for Netflix in over a year because they've got so much content and there's stuff that I enjoy. You can always find something made for you, but you also, it's really easy. This has always been a problem with Netflix for me is that you can just browse and browse and browse. It's what I want to watch, and the Apple TV Plus, the thing there that's, it's their weakness, but there's only so much content. And most of it, if it was in Netflix, I would ignore because it would just be part of that river of content that doesn't speak to me, at a glance. But because of trying out Apple's new service is a thing, then I could spend time with things I wouldn't watch otherwise. With Netflix, I just can't spend time with everything that they have because they add hundreds of things a month, but I've decided between having TV Plus free for the year, paying for the year of Disney Plus, I've lowered my Hulu plan from the live TV version with the on-demand stuff to just the on-demand stuff. In a few days, it'll go back down to $8 or so or less, instead of $45 or $50. And then I've got HBO Go through my AT&T plan. Apparently for a long time, I didn't realize that, but if you have unlimited data, then you can do that with either that or Spotify or Showtime or other services that I've got a lot of stuff there. Oh, and Prime, Amazon Prime. As long as I pay for Prime, I've got their video content, which is, again, it's like not a whole lot of stuff. The Prime issue is that there's a bunch of stuff that you can purchase, like you can do in iTunes from the TV app. So they show you a lot more than you really get. But yeah, I haven't paid for Netflix in a long time. And so I don't feel like I missed out on anything, at least.
Fair enough.
Yep. And I guess the other thing with TV Plus is now we're just 2 weeks away from the launch of the M. Night Shyamalan series, Servant. And will that be the first new edition since just new episodes of the original stuff?
Yeah, that's the first edition. And then they follow up with Truth Be Told and the Halal film on December 6th. So yeah, Thanksgiving Servant is the first new one.
Yeah. How do you know how many you get on Thanksgiving Day? Three? One? All of them?
I think it's three.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty cool. So you get an hour and a half or so. No, how long are the episodes? You know, if they're
hour and half an hour. That's part of the gimmick of the Servant show is that, like, you don't get many thrillers that are half an hour long. So that's part of their like marketing for it is a half an hour thriller.
Yeah. I think The Mandalorian on Disney Plus was like 39 minutes, so it's not an hour and it's not 30 minutes. It's 39 minutes. So it's, I guess without ads, it's a whole, you know, dynamic of just whatever you want it to be. But yeah, well, I wish you had Disney Plus. Oh, one last thing we should mention before we go away is that the tvOS 13.3 beta, so that's the software for the Apple TV 4 and 4K, or HD and 4K now as they're called. We complained when tvOS 13 came out and they replaced the up next queue picker from the home screen on the top shelf if you have the TV app there with these big previews of content. Before TV Plus, it was just movies that you can buy. So it's just ads, basically, unless you already had the movie. Then now they've changed that to you have a toggle. Is that right?
Yeah. So the what to watch list is what they used to have there is like the full screen trailers, which is picked by humans, but it's not personalized to you. So it's essentially adverts. And now in tvOS 13.3, you can dive into the settings and there's a top shelf option for the TV app and you can switch from what to watch back to up next. And the up next design is basically bringing back what was there with tvOS 12. Like you don't get any of the full screen fancy animations or anything. It just puts your up next queue on the top of the screen. Thank you very much. I love it.
That's like, all you need. Like, all you need.
The what to watch thing, it was pretty, but it was completely useless because it wasn't your queue and it wasn't personalized to you. And I don't want to see adverts. I'm paying for TV Plus. Don't show me ads, right? We have this problem inside the app, and then we had the problem on the home screen as well. And now when tvOS 13.3 ships, we can at least change it back again so you can get your app next queue and you can directly go in and watch shows from the home screen without having to actually launch the TV app itself.
Doesn't affect music, which has like music videos playlists as their big full screen thing, and doesn't affect arcade, which is like game trailers. But your point on that was at least you're paying for the content that's there.
Well, yeah, like on music and arcade, assuming you're paying, because if you're not paying for music or arcade, you're not going to have them in your dock anyway, right? So they're not going to be top shelf items. But if you are paying for them, you can put them into your top shelf, and everything you see in the top shelf, you can play or you can listen to. Because it's all inclusive subscriptions with TV, it's not the case.
Yeah, even with the launch of TV Plus, they still have iTunes content and content.
Yeah, I'd be pretty happy if I could just say, show me all the TV Plus stuff in the top shelf. Because then it's like I can watch all of it, right? And you can like attract me to this new material. But no, it's just we're just going to show you all these movies. Like right now in the US, if you on What to Watch, you've got The Mandalorian. But if that will show there, regardless of whether you're paying for Disney Plus or not, it's essentially advertising.
Yeah. So I promptly turned that on as soon as you alerted me to it. So, and it will stay that way because it really is like you skip a step of launching the TV app. If all you care about is seeing your like watch list, that's what Up Next essentially is whenever you make it that way, like when you add something to your list. And you see the same row of information. If you opened it, now you get it from the home screen, like it used to work in iOS 12, which is like so many of the changes, or tvOS 12, so many of the good changes lately, you know, we mentioned this before the show, is like adding toggles to complaints that we had, you know, whether it's home
basically
grouping.
Reverting to how it worked before.
Indeed. Yeah. So, all right. That is the Happy Hour podcast for this week. If you enjoy the show, please leave us a review on Apple Podcast or recommend us in Overcast. We really appreciate that. If you have any feedback for the show, you can email us at happyhour@9to5mac.com, or you can follow us. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at ApolloZac, APOLLOZAC. And Benjamin, you're on Twitter at
BZAMayo.
And we will be back next week. Bye, everybody.
Goodbye.